This fall, we've been walking through the whole Old Testament, and next week we're going to start into the New Testament. This morning we're going to look at Isaiah, but I want to help you remember, again, what the story of God with His people looks like. God creates the world, and He creates the world good. He brings light out of darkness. He brings order out of chaos. And He makes the world a garden that is filled with shalom, which is peace. But it's not just the absence of conflict. Peace, in the biblical term, shalom, is the presence of all things good. And so He plants that garden, and He places human beings in the midst of that garden as the crown of His creation. Human beings are created to tend, to care for the creation, all of creation, to live in shalom with creation and with each other, to be in relationship with God vertically, to be in relationship with others horizontally. Human beings make a decision to seek to live life without God, outside of the bounds in which God has determined, to say, we want to do life on our own. And so there's brokenness that enters the world. Brokenness in relationship between God and men and women. Brokenness in our relationship with ourselves, so we become people of turmoil inside. Broken relationships between human beings and human beings in a variety of ways. Broken relationship between human beings and the earth. And so ever since that time, we have lived in a world that is filled with not only the goodness of creation, but also the badness of sin. We live in a world that not only reflects the brilliance of God's majesty, but we also live in a world that reflects the brokenness of life seeking to live without God. God does not leave us alone. The story of the Old Testament is God in a variety of ways reaching out, pursuing in a relentless fashion human beings in order to restore that relationship. The brokenness creates a world in which power plays, power struggles, one form of dominance or another that is inappropriate rules the day. And also violence enters into the life of this world. And so throughout human history, what we read is the history of violence. Not just nation against nation. People against people. Parents being violent toward children. Children being violent toward each other and toward their parents. And not just that kind of violence that we experienced this last weekend, but the violence that's done to human bodies through the brokenness of cancer. So whether you're talking about the cancer that my nephew Luke at 7 years old is dealing with, or you're talking about the cancer in a society that produces the kind of violence that took place in Newtown, it's all a reflection of that brokenness that entered the world through the rejection of God. So God reaches out and He grabs a hold of Abraham and Sarah. And He creates a people through whom it is His intention to show the world what shalom looks like. To show the world what righteousness and justice looks like. And to be agents of redemption. To bring light into darkness. To be a light to the nations. To be the bringers of shalom. Justice and righteousness. But the story of his people is a story of people who repeatedly do exactly what Adam and Eve did, which is to reject the one true living God and seek to live life on their own terms. And so the people that he called to be a part of the solution became part of the problem. In the midst of that, a nation is created. And they have one brief period of time in which there's an approximation of wholehearted devotion toward God, an approximation of what shalom might look like through the reign of David. And so David becomes the symbol for the people of Israel of what the golden age of God looks like. But it doesn't last long, and the kingdom is divided. And the story of the north kingdom and the southern kingdom is a story of repeated cycles of violence, injustice, oppression, idolatry. And God raises up prophets to speak to the kings in particular, as well as to the people, to call them back, to warn them, say, if you don't turn, this is what's going to happen to you. Not just as an act of punishment, but even as the same way as what happened in the garden, as the natural result of what happens when you reject God. And so we know what that looks like. It's in our face this week. The story of Cain and Abel is the story of a brother killing his brother. And then shortly thereafter, one of Cain's descendants, Lamech, says, if you think Cain was bad, I'm a bad, bad guy. Don't mess with me. And so we have this repeated story of violence. And into that violence, the prophets speak. And they say, turn. Return to God. And then they also give a message of hope. When you come to the book of Isaiah, Isaiah is divided into two sections. The first 39 chapters are written by one man, and the last chapters from 40 on are written by another Isaiah, second Isaiah. The first part happens before exile takes place. The second part happens while exile is happening. As I said last week, exile is not just an issue of geographical boundaries. Exile is a place in the heart. Exile is a station that exists when we don't align ourselves with the purposes of God. The shooter was in exile. His life was oppressed, and he became an oppressor. We always risk being people in exile. Whenever we choose to go our own way, to turn from the one true living God, to make gods of our own making, and because we don't make little idols that sit on a shelf, we think we're not idolaters. But we make our own God, rather than one true God of Israel. We make up our own gods. And so the prophets speak to us, and they speak to us and say, turn and come back. But they also speak words of hope. This morning what I want to do is just read some passages from Isaiah. Some are familiar. In Isaiah 7, the prophet is speaking to the king. Isaiah said, listen, well, you royal family of David, you aren't satisfied to exhaust my patience. You exhaust the patience of God as well. All right then, the Lord himself will choose a sign. Look, the virgin will conceive a child. She will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel, God with us. And by time this child is old enough to eat curds and honey, he will know enough to choose what is right and reject what is wrong. But before he knows right from wrong, the two kings you fear so much, the kings of Israel and Aram, will both be dead. Now, remember what I said last week, that the basic role of the prophet was not to predict the future, but to foretell a message from God for the people that time. And what Isaiah is saying to the king is, the things that you fear are going to be taken care of, and here's the sign. A young woman will conceive and bear a son. And he goes on to describe who that son is. So in the first instance, it's not talking about Jesus. But you fast forward to the New Testament, and in Matthew 1, 18 to 25, that text is quoted to say, this is all about Jesus. Part of the reason the New Testament writers do that is they have come to the understanding that the real exile began not when Israel was taken over by Assyria or Judah was taken over by Babylon. The real exile took place back in the garden. And so all human beings, in one way or another, live in exile. And so the problem is much bigger than just bringing Israel back from exile to be a nation again. It's to bring the whole world back from exile. And there's going to be a sign. And the sign is this son who's going to be born. And then Isaiah 9. Nevertheless, this time of darkness and despair will not go on forever. In other words, I know things are bad. I know it's dark. I know it's despairing. But it won't go on forever. The land of Zebulun and Naphtali will soon be humbled, but there will be a time in which the future, when Galilee of the Gentiles, which lies along the road that runs between the Jordan and the sea, will be filled with glory. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light, a light that will shine on all who live in that land where death casts its shadow. Israel will again be great, and its people will rejoice as people rejoice at harvest time. They will shout with joy like warriors dividing the plunder. For God will break the chains that bind his people, the whip that scourges them, just as he did when he destroyed the army of Midian with Gideon's little band. In that day of peace, battle gear will no longer be issued. Never again will uniforms be bloodstained by war. All such equipment will be burned. For a child is born to us, a son is given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. These will be his royal titles: Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, Prince of Shalom. His ever-expanding peaceful government will never end, and he will rule forever with fairness and justice, with justice and righteousness. From the throne of his ancestor David, the passionate commitment of the Lord Almighty guarantees this. You read those words, and we, in the 21st century, have the benefit of looking back and understanding that that was not just a word for Israel, that is a word for us. It's a word for the world. God is going to do something great and good to redeem his broken world. That passage is quoted in Matthew 4, 12 to 17. Again, pointing us toward Jesus. Chapter 11. Out of the stump of David's family will grow a shoot, yes, a new branch, bearing fruit from the old root. And the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. He will delight in obeying the Lord. He will never judge by appearance, false evidence, or hearsay. He will defend the poor and the exploited. He will rule against the wicked and destroy them with the breath of his mouth. He will be clothed with fairness and truth, with justice and righteousness. In that day, the wolf and the lamb will lie down together. The leopard and the goat will be at peace, shalom. Calves and yearlings will be safe among the lions, and a little child will lead them all. The cattle will graze among bears. Cubs and calves will lie down together, and lions will eat grass as the livestock do. Babies will crawl safely among poisonous snakes. Yet a little child will put in its hand in a nest of deadly snakes and pull it out unharmed. Nothing will hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. As the waters fill the sea, so the earth will be filled with people who know the Lord. Again, we read those words from our perspective and we realize that he's not just talking about something that's going to happen for Israel. He's talking about something that is going to happen for the entire world, because the entire world is in bondage. And there's need for deliverance. Did you listen to the words that we sang this morning? We need deliverance. We need deliverance. What happens here in this passage, and as he goes on to talk about it, is the promise of a new Exodus, the promise of a new golden age, the promise of a new golden king. And that golden age is ushered in by the Messiah. That golden king is the Messiah. And the Messiah will accomplish his own Exodus. When you read chapter 9 of Luke, which is the story of the Mount of Transfiguration, where Jesus meets on the mountain with Moses and Elijah, and Peter and his companions want to build tents there and live there. One of the things that takes place is they're talking with each other, and what it says is that Jesus, they're talking about the exodus that Jesus is going to accomplish in Jerusalem. Literally, that's the word that is used. A new exodus, a new deliverance from bondage that is like what happened with Israel in Egypt and bringing them out of Egypt, but is greater than that, because it's not just for Israel. If you fast forward to Isaiah 40, "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. Tell her that her sad days are gone and her sins are pardoned. Yes, the Lord has punished her in full for all her sins. Listen, I hear the voice of someone shouting, 'Make a highway for the Lord through the wilderness. Make a straight and smooth road through the desert for our God. Fill the valleys and level the hills. Straighten out the curves and smooth off the rough spots. Then the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all people will see it together. The Lord has spoken.'" Those very words are quoted in Matthew 3, 1 to 3, talking about what John the Baptist is going to do. Comfort, comfort my people with these words. I was reading a passage from a piece of writing that N.T. Wright wrote about this Isaiah 40. He says, "Every fresh wave of God's comfort picks up energy and direction from the ways that have gone before." And what he's talking about here in this text is a new wave of comfort, a lively, splashing, refreshing wave coming on God's tide to fill up the dry pools of other people's lives with new life. And he goes on to say, we are called, God's people, we are called to be waiting companions with others in their dryness. We may not be able to cross the country and go to Connecticut, but we can walk across the room and be waiting companions with those who struggle right now in this room, who've experienced loss and grief and are longing for comfort. We're called to be waiting companions. We're also called to be wise witnesses, where we don't say trivial things, where we don't trivialize what has happened in someone's life, but we bear witness to the truth of the Holy One of Israel, Emmanuel, God come in the flesh, to recognize that there is hope because light has shone in the darkness, and the light is to shine through us. We are to be people of light. And we are also called to be wounded healers, because everybody here experiences wounds like these in one way or another. Even as Christ is a wounded healer on the cross, so we are to go to our own crosses. And we are to bring our own wounds to the Lord. and allow him to comfort us. And then, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians, to take that comfort with which we have been comforted and to bring that to others who walk in darkness and despair, so that we become pillars of hope. Not because we say trivial things to people, but because we are present and we bring our own woundedness to be used. We become Jesus' people. Isaiah 42. I'm way over time. Look at my servant whom I strengthen. He is my chosen one, and I am pleased with him. I have put my spirit upon him. He will reveal justice to the nations. He will be gentle. He will not raise his voice or shout in public. He will not crush those who are weak or quench the smallest hope. He will bring full justice to all who have been wronged. He will not stop until truth and righteousness prevail throughout all the earth. Even distant lands beyond the sea will wait for his instruction. And God says to his servant, you will be a light to guide all nations to me. You will open the eyes of the blind and free the captives from prison. You will release those who sit in darkness. I am the Lord. That is my name. I will not give my glory to anyone else. I will not share my praise with carved idols. Everything I prophesied will come true. And now I will prophesy again. I will tell you the future before it happens. What Isaiah says is a son of David will come and he will lead a new exodus, showing the way to a new city and a new temple, displaying a new humility. We can go on and on. Isaiah 52. Go now, leave your bonds in slavery, put Babylon behind you with everything it represents, for it is unclean to you. You are the Lord's holy people. Purify yourselves, you who carry home the vessels of the Lord. See, my servant will prosper. He will be highly exalted. Many were amazed when they saw him, beaten and bloodied, so disfigured no one could scarcely know he was a person. And he will again startle many nations. Kings will stand speechless in his presence. For see, they will see what they had previously been told about. They will understand what they had not heard about. What Isaiah is prophesying about is that the answer to the world's issues, all of them, are bound up into the arrival of the new king. Is it? It is true. And as I said 2 weeks ago, that new king has come and he's been enthroned, and his enthronement was on a cross. And he calls people to himself, and he calls you and me to be his followers. Part of our mission statement is to inspire people to follow him with wholehearted devotion, which means that we become people of the cross. Last night, as I was watching the news, there was a father who had lost his 6-year-old child. It was the most amazing testimony I've ever heard. Without using any God talk, without using any trivial Christian language, he testified to the reality of goodness and grace, righteousness and truth, forgiveness and health. I said to Nancy, that was an amazing message. We need to be that kind of people. Father, give us the ability to love each other and to love others, and to live as people who follow you completely, wholeheartedly. Because you are the only light to the nations. You are the only hope for the world. And you've called us to be your witnesses. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.